Remember to write your questions down. On those question form, there's a spot for your name. You certainly feel free to remain anonymous. We won't call you out. Our next speaker this morning is Dr. Pat McGrath. Like Dr. Kroos, he did his undergraduate training at the University of Notre Dame. I think Dr. Renfroll is here, so there's three of them in the room. Hopefully that's it. After completing college, he received his master's in microbiology along with his medical degree at the University of Illinois in Chicago. He subsequently did a surgical training at the Medical College of Virginia in Richmond. And in the midst of that training, he did a research fellowship in surgical oncology. And following his residency training, he did additional fellowship training both in research and clinical surgical oncology. Following his training, he went to Lexington, Kentucky, where he has been since that time. He's currently the Ward O. Griffin Endowed Chair of Surgery at the University of Kentucky in Lexington. Dr. McGrath has held numerous leadership positions, both locally and nationally, and received numerous awards, many in the area of surgical teaching, which is particularly impressive. Like almost all of our speakers, he's extensively published, both in peer-reviewed journals, as well as editorial boards and book chapters. Dr. McGrath's first talk this morning is on strategies for the treatment of complex malignancies. Thank you, Dr. McGrath.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here. And what I thought I would like to do with this first talk would be to kind of go over several different scenarios where you might think twice about just going right to the operating room. And sometimes that's hard for surgeons, and especially if you're kind of out there alone, to know when to jump right into surgery or whether to step back and look at other possible therapies in conjunction with surgery. And also to discuss the value of our multidisciplinary planning that we have and most major medical centers do have. And I've found it to be extremely important in terms of sort of patient management. So let's get right on to it. The first case is a patient with a GI stromal tumor. So it's a 59-year-old black female who presented with a 15-centimeter mass in the left upper outer quadrant. This appeared to be coming mostly occupying the lesser sac, but there was a possibility that it was involving the pancreatic body and tail. We went ahead and did CT staging as well as an endoscopic ultrasound to determine, number one, the origin of the tumor, as well as whether or not there was involvement with the pancreas. We have found EUS to be extremely sensitive when you are trying to answer a specific question, and they can look at those specific areas. So then we presented this case at the Multidisciplinary GI Oncology Conference, and decision was made to consider treating this patient actually up front in a neoadjuvant setting with Gleevec. The question that comes up all the time is then, how long do you treat this patient prior to considering surgical resection? And generally, our attitude is to go ahead and treat to the point of maximum radiographic response. This is a view of the tumor that's taken up most of the left upper quadrant. As you can see, it's intimately associated. It had been intimately associated with the pancreas capsule. But after 6 months of treatment, this tumor that had been 18 centimeters is now down to 13 centimeters. Another scan at 9 months shows that it's probably reached maximal response. It is probably about 12 centimeters at this point, and it was felt that this would be the appropriate time to go in and operate. The other key thing with any neoadjuvant therapy is to determine that, in fact, there's not been progression of disease. There's no development of distant metastases. And so in this particular case, the patient was taken to the operating room and had a partial gastrectomy. This was coming off the posterior wall of the stomach, able to do an en bloc resection of the tumor in the posterior wall of the stomach without doing a complete gastrectomy. Primary repair of the stomach wall was obtained. And again, there was no invasion on the U.S. The dissection was able to be performed off the capsule of the pancreas. And this is a picture of the specimen with the wall of the stomach, the GI stromal tumor coming off the posterior wall of the stomach. And the final pathology showed that, in fact, there was no residual viable tumor. Margins, obviously, were negative for malignancy. So it's a strategy that we start to employ more and more in some of the larger GI stromal tumors. This is not a very common tumor. These have shown a gain in function of mutation in the tyrosine kinase. And targeted therapy with a tyrosine kinase inhibitor has proved dramatic in the outcome of these tumors. When you take a look at prognosis historically with GI stromal tumors, the three factors we look at are the mitotic rate, the size of the tumor, and the location of the tumor. And this is just sort of a graph showing you various rates of recurrence based on mitotic rate. Good is less than 5 per 50 high power field. When it starts getting more than that, that's concerning. Tumors that start getting larger than 10 centimeters have a much higher recurrence rate. And then obviously location matters, and stomach tends to do a little better than duodenum, jejunum. In general, we tend to operate on all lesions that are greater than 2 centimeters. There are some that are less than 2 centimeters that can safely be watched. You know, Gleevec was originally used just for metastatic disease. And the response that was seen with this tyrosine kinase inhibitor was so dramatic, and the medication was so well tolerated, then studies started looking at patients that were going to be high risk for recurrence. And in fact, there was dramatic improvement in survival in that group of patients. Then it started migrating over into the neoadjuvant setting. And again, we'll see some of these patients show up with extremely large tumors. And the strategy of using Gleevec in a neoadjuvant setting has been dramatic. We've seen decreased recurrence in studies all the way 1, 2, and 5 years out. The recurrence-free survival now at 2 years is 83%. In the pre-Gleevec era, the median survival for these was probably 18 months. Now the median survival is over 5 years. So it has been a dramatic sort of response to treatment. Again, it's been easy in the past. We'd go in and resect these large tumors, and then we'd consider putting the patient on it. Now we're just starting to sit back and maybe look at the potential benefit of giving Gleevec up front in a neoadjuvant setting. Let's move on to a different tumor type that, again, has benefited significantly and through sort of multidisciplinary planning. And I will tell you that I guess I'm old enough now that I've lived through the multiple generations of pancreatic surgery. I've seen it all to the point where we'd go in and biopsy a lymph node, and if it was positive, that was it, case over. All the way up to now, some of the more thoughtful approaches to it. But I did live in an era where, boy, if you had a lesion that was even remotely resectable, we'd take that patient immediately to the operating room. And a lot of it is because we like doing the operation. This was a patient who was 34 years old and presented with epigastric pain. No jaundice. The patient had lap coli 6 months prior. It is amazing the number, and again, this is all retrospect, but the number of patients that have had lap coli prior to seeing them for evaluation of their pancreatic cancer. The patient had a mass in the head of the pancreas. It was confirmed by EUS biopsy. This has been the number one benefit over the years that I've seen is the ability to get a nice biopsy with EUS. It shows you nodes, and it really helps with treatment planning. Again, CT staging showed no mets, but it did show what appeared to be encasement of the SMV portal vein complex. This is what we define as a borderline resectable pancreatic carcinoma. And these are the cases when we define that in tumor board that we talk about treatment up front. We went ahead and had a metal stent placed, and then the patient received neoadjuvant radiation chemotherapy. This is a view of the malignancy that you can see, protein splenic vein, and this is at the SMV portal vein junction. This is a little better view where you can nicely see that there is encasement of that SMV portal vein. If you look at the response before and after neoadjuvant therapy, you are probably saying that you're not really seeing much in the way of a response, and you'd be correct. But radiographic studies, we found out, really may not reflect the true response that you're seeing in these patients. And then the question comes up, and you'll see that across a variety of tumor types. Neoadjuvant therapy doesn't always dramatically shrink it down, especially if you're using radiation therapy. But then the question is, what about the patient CA19-9? So this is what we found out to be particularly helpful, especially if you have a markedly elevated CA19-9, as this patient did at the start of neoadjuvant therapy, and you watch the decline to normal levels at the time of your surgical resection. In fact, if you take a look at data that's been presented looking at CA normalization and survival, those patients that were able to be resected and have a normal post-neoadjuvant CA19-9 are the ones that have the best survival, and that's approaching 40%. So that's pretty significant. Those patients that still had an abnormal CA19-9 had a significant drop-off, but it was better if they were obviously able to be resected than non-resected. This is just kind of shows you a little bit of the anatomy of what we are dealing with. And again, the encasement was right at this location where they usually are. So the patient underwent a Whipple procedure with a resection of the portal SMV vein, able to preserve the ileal jejunal branches as well as the coronary vein. This is just a view. It's a little bit, it's skewed for standing on the left side of the table. But at any rate, splenic vein, there's cut edge of the pancreas. And this is just prior to clamping and performing the resection and then quickly going on to the vein resection, which is identified right there. Final pathology showed that, in fact, the patient still had a T3 tumor with extension in the peripancreatic soft tissue. But the margins were free, and there were 20 negative nodes. So again, probably in the past, this would have been deemed unresectable, never would have even been considered for surgery. But treatment up front, reanalysis, and considerations for resection have been, I think, valuable in this group of patients. The neoadjuvant therapy also kind of, if you break it down and look at survival after neoadjuvant therapy, those patients that are rendered node negative, and the majority of patients that you end up taking for resection for pancreatic cancers, the majority end up having positive nodes. So those patients that are node negative, theoretically from their neoadjuvant therapy, have a significant improved survival in the group of patients that had 1 to 3 nodes or more than four nodes. This is one thing that, looking back over my career, I would say probably has been one of the more significant lessons learned, and that is in certain cancers, it's really important to be able to complete the multimodality therapy. And, you know, in patients that have undergone a Whipple procedure, those patients have complications, and sometimes complications are significant enough that they are too sick to go on and receive effective adjuvant therapy. And so the strategy for looking to complete your multimodality therapy up front is significant. And just if you took all patients that were able to receive their multimodality therapy versus ones that were not, there is a huge survival advantage. Thirty-six versus 11 months. So again, breaking down, if you know that you're going to do your operation with no complications and the patient's going to recuperate within the month and then go on and receive multimodality therapy, there is no difference in survival with given that neoadjuvant therapy upfront or adjuvant therapy post-op. But in a group of patients that have pretty significant morbidity and some mortality, there is certainly a benefit to considering the strategy of neoadjuvant therapy up front. All right, moving on. Another area of concern in terms of trying to figure out what's the best approach is patients with gastric cardiac cancer. And again, we're starting to see the gastric cancers move more and more proximal to the point that they're outnumbering the distal ones here now. This is a patient that had a GE junction mass, biopsy was cancer, it was either T3 or T4 by CT scan and had positive nodes. Proximal stomach was totally involved, and this patient was evaluated in the GI oncology conference. Plan was for neoadjuvant radiation and chemotherapy prior to surgery. And this is a view of the gastric cancer, cardia origin. Note the thickness of the stomach. After treatment, you can see that the proximal stomach is less thick, and there certainly has been no progression. So then the question is, what's the right surgical approach? Esophagectomy, gastrectomy? These are some of the more difficult cases. Going back to Seward's sort of classic publication back in 2000, looking at some of the nodal extension in patients with type 2 tumors, Seward 2, which sort of bridge the lower esophagus and stomach. The majority of the nodes are going to be at the GE junction, but also riding along the lesser curvature. In his paper, this is just a description of the different types. Type 1, totally involved in the distal esophagus, type 2 bridging, and then type 3 more so in the stomach with extension up into the esophagus. Clearly, type 1 is always treated with esophagectomy. Back at that point, he'd recommended extended gastrectomy for type 2 and 3 because the mortality for esophagectomy was higher. We just recently presented an analysis of the Nisqually and Sear patients at the Southern Surgical, which sort of tried to answer the questions, what is the appropriate operation? And the bottom line is it turned out to be a wash, that the outcome was the same, whether it was by esophagectomy or gastrectomy. A lot of it had to do with referral patterns. The overwhelming majority of patients were actually had esophagectomies for these Seward type 2 cancers because they were referred to thoracic surgeons. The decisions really, I think, come down to taking a look at the tumor anatomy, the extension in the esophagus, as well as looking at, you know, what the morbidity and mortality rates are within the hospital among the specific surgeons doing these cases. And also, one of the key things of this whole thing where we did show an improved survival is patients receiving multimodality therapy. So you have to take, again, a look at the completion rate of that therapy. So when we approach these cases at UK, we have a tumor board with both thoracic and abdominal surgical oncologists at the tumor board. We get CT scans with gastric distension to try and get a better feel for extent of the gastric portion. We do repeat endoscopy unless they had their endoscopy at our institution. And part of that is to really to identify the location of the tumor. You want to take a look at the proximal extent and determine what would be the best operation. Some will do staging laparoscopy with peritoneal washings in these settings because of the high rate of peritoneal metastasis. And then we decide our final surgical approach after neoadjuvant therapy. You know, the bottom line is that we have adopted a policy in which it's a combined approach. One of the thoracic surgeons is pretty facile with VATS and complete mobilization of the esophagus. He also is able to sample some of the nodes in the mediastinum. But that esophageal mobilization plus a total gastrectomy allows that 6 centimeters of esophagus to be resected and to have a more tension-free anastomosis. And I think that's been one of the key things. In this particular case, that's what was done. And this is a view of the operative specimen with the esophageal portion there. It's always a little disconcerting when you have about what appears to be about 6 centimeters of esophagus on stretch, specimen comes out, and then it shrinks on down, and you're trying to tell everybody, no, it was way longer in the operating room. I have a picture that shows how long it was in the operating room. But anyway, this patient had a little residual primary tumor and had clear margins. And one of the keys, you know, is that there was 27 negative nodes. That's a good sampling from the chest to the pylorus. So again, I think it depends on the institution, but in our particular case, we've certainly started this series of esophageal mobilization combined with a total gastrectomy. Now, sort of along the same lines, this was 2 months ago I had this case presented. This is in the midst of our push for sort of neoadjuvant therapy, and this was a 53-year-old female that had the typical 6-month history, nausea, vomiting, fullness, 30-pound weight loss, large mass lesion in the antrum. And the patient essentially had, this was circumferential, had a gastric outlet obstruction. The original biopsy showed inflammation and necrosis. This was done at an outside institution, and they sent the specimen off for flow cytometry because there was consideration that it could possibly even be a lymphoma. The person reading the flow cytometry said they saw signet ring cells and that this is a poorly differentiated adenocarcinoma. And so the patient came to me with that sort of bill of sale, and we discussed her case at our multidisciplinary GI oncology conference, and we did not have the slides yet. But decisions were clearly this patient would benefit from neoadjuvant therapy because when you look, there's the tumor, already signs of gastric outlet obstruction. And it was actually encroaching onto the capsule of the pancreas. And I'd had one of those the year previous that ended up having to do a Whipple on, so I wasn't too keen on that. So we wanted to get this patient treated up front. And when we finally got the slides, our pathologist said they couldn't confirm malignancy. I said, this has to be malignant. We're going to re-biopsy it. So I made him do 12 biopsies, and again, it only revealed inflammation necrosis. So you can't give neoadjuvant therapy if you don't have a diagnosis of malignancy. So we went and took the patient to the operating room and did a cancer operation with a subtotal gastrectomy, and of course, final pathology showed peptic ulcer disease. So, you know, you got to be a little careful. So if it looks like cancer, doesn't mean it always is. And, you know, you certainly can't give treatment up front. All right, I'm going to switch gears a little bit for the last little bit and talk about some other cases where I think it's very useful before you go jumping into surgery to sort of have the whole team on board with what the treatment plan is going to be. And to me, some of the most challenging is breast cancer and pregnancy. I had a 25-year-old patient present with who was 15 weeks pregnant with a mass in the upper outer quadrant. The core biopsy, of course, showed that this was a poorly invasive ductal carcinoma. And this is a picture of the mass, which was approximately 3 centimeters in size. Ultrasound confirmed that. And we went into treatment planning. It was felt after discussion with medical oncologists, radiation oncologists, all in attendance at conference, that we would go ahead and proceed with a lumpectomy and sentinel node biopsy, as well as a port placement, because this tumor was hormone receptor negative. The patient was going to eventually require adjuvant therapy. Final pathology showed, in fact, that it was 3-centimeter poorly differentiated, node negative, margins clear. It was hormone receptor negative, but HER2 positive. The decision was then in the second trimester to go ahead with AC for 4 cycles every 3 weeks. That got her to about 30 weeks. We moved her delivery up just a little bit to 34 weeks. Again, the other people you have to get involved with are high-risk OB. So they were on board. She delivered a healthy baby at 34 weeks. Shortly after delivery, the patient went on to receive radiation therapy and Herceptin for a year. Sort of another end of the spectrum was a case this last year, because they come in sort of all varieties, not all of them. The first is sort of the typical presentation of what we see with the more aggressive advanced cases during pregnancy. But occasionally you just get surprised, and this was a 44-year-old white female who presented with some mammographic architectural distortion. Biopsy showed a well-differentiated invasive ductal carcinoma with lobular features. This, as you would figure, is strongly hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative. Ultrasound of the axilla was negative. When you looked at the mammogram, the pattern was extremely dense, and it was suggestive of possible multifocal disease. So the next step would be to go ahead and get an MRI, which we recommended. Patient went over to get the MRI. They did a pre-MRI pregnancy test, and lo and behold, she was pregnant, unbeknownst to her. So now we're in that situation. The patient's 44, but last year actually had a miscarriage and desired the pregnancy. She still, because of her age and other factors, was still high risk for miscarriage. And so we talked long and hard about surgical options. Because of the biologic nature of this particular tumor, we had the luxury of waiting a little bit till she got into the second trimester. After a long discussion, she elected to have a total mastectomy and sentinel node biopsy in the beginning of the second trimester. And this proved to be a stage one well-differentiated invasive ductal carcinoma. She went on and delivered a healthy baby, and then at completion of delivery went on to tamoxifen therapy. So, you know, a lot has changed over the years in terms of management of breast cancer during pregnancies. And it used to be that you just immediately took the patient to the operating room, did a mastectomy, period, end of discussion. And then there was a period where we didn't know what to do with sentinel nodes. We didn't know what to do with blue dye. So a lot of these questions actually have been sorted out. And probably in the last, 6 years, we've had probably 10 patients with pregnancy, the whole spectrum, most of which have been treated with chemotherapy during their second trimester. All have delivered healthy babies and have done well. So and again, if the patient desires breast conservation, we'll treat them up front with neoadjuvant chemotherapy and delay surgery till after they've delivered. But you can give adjuvant chemotherapy or neoadjuvant chemotherapy in the second trimester. You can operate in the second trimester. We hold off on radiation therapy till postpartum. We hold off on endocrine therapy till postpartum. The majority of these are poorly differentiated. They are a more advanced stage. Mammograms are okay during pregnancy as long as they're shielded appropriately. We avoid MRI in general. It's avoided in the first trimester, and you can't give gadolinium. It's contraindicated. So in general, we don't give MRIs during pregnancy. And that was sort of the dilemma we had in the other patient. It worked out that she did have a multifocal process, but the MRI would have helped in that setting. We don't give chemo in the first trimester. It's okay in the second and third trimester. In our little cohort of patients, we've not had any baby delivered with any problems. And we've followed them long enough that they're normal. We don't give radiation during pregnancy. We don't give blue dye during pregnancy. There have been some adverse reactions in general, and so it's nobody's willing to go down there. But they found out that it is safe to give to do sentinel node mapping with the radioactive particles. Herceptin is contraindicated during pregnancy. And again, surgery, either mastectomy or breast conservation surgery, is fine during the second and third trimester. Now, moving on to a final discussion, that is going to be, again, I know we're going to have a lecture on neoadjuvant therapy and breast cancer, but this is actually where the surgeon and the medical oncologist have to get together for some of these unusual cases where neoadjuvant endocrine therapy would be beneficial up front. So I had a patient that I could tell before going into the room, due to the smell, that the patient had a fairly advanced breast cancer, 69, and actually had a 10-year history of having a mass, an axillary mass. And this is a picture of the mass that you could fit most of your fist in. And you knew right away that a tumor like that in a patient that's still with us is going to be strongly hormone receptor positive. These tumors are slower growing, and when they present like this, they are all strongly hormone receptor positive. So in the clinic there, we just went ahead and cleaned up the wound, debrided it somewhat, did biopsies showing that it was an invasive ductal carcinoma. It was moderately differentiated, and as we predicted, was 100% estrogen receptor positive. She had clinically positive nodes, but imaging showed no evidence of distant disease. So we debrided the wound. We started on an aromatase inhibitor for a total of 8 months, monitoring her wound during that whole time period. And at the end of 8 months, we had a dramatic response, as you will see in these cases. And it certainly made her surgery much easier. This is her in the operating room, and that was her resection with a complete modified radical mastectomy. And as you recall, we had to come across sort of midline to resect that entire area. But that's when you call on your colleagues in plastic surgery to just rotate a tram flap. We weren't trying to reconstruct her for cosmetic, but actually to get coverage. And she did great, and she continues to do well. And they're not always that dramatic. You know, there's times that you might want to think about this in certain settings. This is a patient that had probably close to a 4-centimeter mass. It was still going to be amenable to breast conservation surgery. But as we were discussing options, the patient's biggest concern is she was scheduled that next month to go on and have a hip replacement. And that was her biggest misery. This tumor was very strongly hormone receptor positive. So we placed her also on an aromatase inhibitor and allowed her to go on and get her surgery. This mass then decreased down after about 4 months to 2 centimeters. We went on, did successful breast conservation surgery, and the patient did fine. So, you know, there are times that you can't immediately get to surgery. If the tumor is strongly hormone receptor positive, then it's not unreasonable to give them neoadjuvant therapy. I've also had settings where there have been such a massive hematoma after the core biopsy that I was not going to be able to do successful breast conservation surgery without that hematoma resolving somewhat. I've placed the patient on neoadjuvant endocrine surgery and allowed them to heal up and then go on and have better surgery in the future. So it's an effective strategy not only for locally advanced ER-positive tumors, but also to downstage tumors and to allow breast conservation. It's rare to get a pathologic complete response. But that doesn't mean that it can't downstage these tumors appropriately. It's been shown that aromatase inhibitors are superior to tamoxifen, and Ki-67 is a very useful tool. It is a proliferation marker that you can determine on the original core biopsies. After a month of neoadjuvant endocrine therapy, you can repeat the biopsy and check the Ki-67, and it's real common to see a dramatic response. And so you know your therapy's the correct way to go. And then there are increasing data showing that at least 6 months of treatment is necessary to get real effective. The trouble is, it's hard to convince patients of this, and it's also hard to convince surgeons of this, that that's the correct way to go. But the patients will come back to you, and quite often it's hard. You know, it's done a lot in Europe, and it seems in the States it's a little more difficult to get everybody to take a deep breath and realize this is a good strategy. And that's it. I guess I'll finish just in time. Thank you.
Well, according to my schedule, we're at break time, and also we're about 15 minutes ahead. So let's go ahead and cut about 5 minutes off of our break. So we'll take an extra 10 minutes of break. We'll reconvene at 10:25. That'll give us more time for lunch and visiting at that time. So it's break time. Thanks, everybody.